Now, after having discussed the bargaining power theory, the next theory that follows is the surplus value theory. Now, over here, we all know that after, you know, a specific limit or after the benchmark has been reached, whatever is produced is known as the surplus. For example, if I am, employed in a mobile manufacturing company, like let's say I'm in the management of Samsung, which manufactures mobile units. Now, let's suppose if the monthly target is 1 million mobile phones for a specific region like Maharashtra. And what happens is there's a surplus which is created, like, you know, 1 million plus a 10,000 or a 30,000. Now, this is the amount over 1 million is known as the surplus. Okay, so according to this theory, the surplus produced over and above what is required to survive, okay, is translated into profit in capitalism. So this is more of a profit in the concept of a capitalism. Huh? Since the capitalist, now who is a capitalist and what is capitalism? So person who puts or invests money or resources is known as a capitalist. They're paying out of their pockets. They are paying maybe for the land to establish a factory. They are paying for the infrastructure. They are paying for the raw materials. They are paying for the labors. So since the capitalist pays a laborer for his labor, the capitalist claims to own the means of productions, the worker's labor power, and even the product that is produced. So these are some essentials that this investor tends to own. All right, so this is what they tend to own. Now, this particular theory says that the laborer producing the goods, his efforts are helpful, meaningful to the owner of that business, as the surplus amount goes to the boss instead of the laborer. So the laborers tend to toil, okay, they tend to put in extra efforts, they generate surplus, but it does not go into their pockets. It basically goes into the pockets of the owner or the capitalist, who is actually responsible for carrying out the whole business. For example, if a laborer is instrumental in producing a unit or a part which is sold in the market eventually for 5,000 rupees. Now, he or she produces, let's say, 20 such parts during the course of the day. And in a 24-day month, they might produce something in the tune of a 1200, 1250 parts or, some good amount of parts, but they will not get paid in proportion. They will only get paid a certain amount. The entire amount, the entire surplus would go to the owner and the business. So this is known as the surplus value theory. So value concept and economic surplus are very important in explaining the value creation and the value distribution in the economy. So how is the value being distributed in the ecosystem, in the economy? So from the value creation perspective, the value concept helps in understanding the relationship between the price and the value for a commodity in the market. So price is not the only determinant, it is also how it is perceived by the consumers. So the capitalist might want to promote it in various ways where they are able to increase the basic cost, okay, in which the value is created in the consumption, and the price has a role in the value distribution between the firms and the customers. Now, what this means is that a price is set by the firm, adding some profit into the cost, and it is given to the retailers and wholesalers. But the value is something which want, okay, so the end customers want the product, they need it. Like, let's say now the petrol, the fossil fuels, they are depleting with the current crisis which is happening in Russia and Ukraine. The prices are fluctuating, and if the resources, they get depleted in the next 30 odd years, people will not find value. So even if somebody is selling a petrol-based Mercedes after the next 25 years, in a matter of 10 lakhs, nobody will go for it because they know that there will be no petrol in the next 3-4 years after that. So what is the value created in the consumption is also important, and it's a part of this theory. The labor power, okay, the capitalist has bought. So the capitalist has recruited labor, correct? So for example, if it's a shaft making company, they create shafts, and the shafts subsequently are given to other users. So end users will get those. So if those particular, the labor power the capitalist has bought adds value to that of the used up raw materials and tools, it is known as the surplus value. So for example, if the labor is skilled enough to convert bars or ingots into shafts and precisely calibrated shafts, then it is known that they would be able to add value. If and until that point of time, this added value is inferior or equal to the worker's wage, surplus value cannot originate. So what this ideally means is that if the product from the raw material stage to a finished stage, if there is no change or, there is no tangible change, then there is no additional value. So surplus again can be determined here as additional. Its emergence from the process of production is the precondition for the capitalist hiring workers. So it's the difference between converting a raw material into something valuable. And if that happens, then the capitalist will view the efforts of the laborers as a surplus value. Okay, so this will be the very existence of the capitalist mode of production. So if the capitalist is investing, let's say, an X amount in a raw material, has already invested in labor, the land, the infrastructure, and if he's able to get X plus Y, which is a surplus, okay, an additional value which he can sell for much more in the open market than what the raw material would have, then it is said to have that surplus value. The next important theory that we are going to take a look at is the residual claimant theory. This is a very interesting theory and was devised by the American economist called as Walker. So as per Walker, the wages are nothing but the remainder left in excess of after the other factors of creations have been remunerated. Now, what does this mean? This means is that the person who invests money will be paid the last after he or she is able to deduct everything from what has been invested. We look at this again as we move through this particular theory. So the economic agent who has the sole remaining claim on an organization's net cash is known as the residual claimant. For example, let's say a capitalist builds a small factory unit. He is going to produce some motors or some pumps, okay, some submersible pumps maybe. Now what happens is he has invested in the raw material, he has invested in electricity, he has invested in labor. Now he has actually produced in the very first month some 1,000 motors or pumps. Now these particular pumps, they are costing a certain amount. They cost a certain amount and they have been sold. Now after withdrawing the initial investment, whatever is left goes into the pockets of the investor, and he or she is known as the residual claimant. It is the residue which remains. Let's further look at this particular theory. So according to this theory, after all factors of production, service have received their remuneration. For example, laborers who toil at converting the raw material into the component parts. If the component parts already come, so to assemble those particular parts, all this requires effort and knowledge. So this particular aspect, then maybe The investor has invested in some marketing or promotion methods. So those particular services, if they have paid for an advertisement, you know, those particular agents, all of them, all right, so all of them, after they have received their share, the person or the agent supposed to receive the left residual amount is known as the residual claimant. All right, so the residual claimant receives the remainder of the sum after all costs have been accounted for. For example, a firm might be having several factors engaged directly or indirectly in production, such as laborers, suppliers, bondholders, stakeholders, shareholders, etc. The firm owes, okay, definite amounts to factors like laborers, suppliers, etc. in order to compensate them. So can we expect any labor to work without a compensation? That's not possible. They have to manage their families. They have their own commitments. So they need to be paid on either a daily basis or a monthly basis. So after making all these payments to the parties, the shareholders might be receiving payment in the end. This may be, or they might be receiving the residual amount. So whatever chunk of profit remains after paying off everybody in the due course after the month or the week, that may be the residual amount. So the residual claimant theory is not very helpful in understanding the labor's claim on the productivity. As you see, it's the employer's gain. It is not the labor's claim, because that amount belongs to the capitalist or the stakeholder. So this perspective has nothing got to do with the labor. They just receive a part of the remuneration. The model is correct in thinking the labor works for a wage and the residual income belongs to the person who bears the residual risk. So for example, if I am bearing a risk of putting money into those submersible pumps. So first is, I have to be optimistic enough to know that my people will be able to create a competitive, valuable product. The second thing is, do I have a market where these particular produced products will go and they will be sold? The next thing is there anything else? So there are several risks. Okay. Another thing is my product able to reap certain profit? So these are certain residual risks. Here, what is not clearly understood is why labor bargains rationally for a share of the productivity gains. So in this case, there have been many instances where the labor has said to bargain to take a share of the gains when there is no relationship, because they are not party to the residual risk. Now, the answer has already been discussed in discussions in the first chapter. It is nothing but inflation. So what happens is, as the price of essential goods and services rises, the labor cannot afford to work at the same levels as they've been doing for the the last few months or years. Hence, they need to have more of a share in what is being produced to fight the factor of inflation. There are certain criticisms also. Like in a few previous theories, we've seen criticisms to the theory. So this theory falls short. It has a drawback. It fails to explain the role of trade unions in increasing the wages. Again, this partly may be because of a vested interest in their labors. It may partly be to combat the inflation that is happening. Moreover, Walker, the inventor, did not explain the impact of supply of labor on the wages. So what would happen if additional labor is recruited? What would happen? How would that eat up into the residual claimant's money or that particular share? That has not been explained properly by Walker. In actual practice, it is found that at times of the business booming, when rent, interest, and profits rise, wages also increase at the same time. So this is something of a complexity which has not been understood fully as per the practices of this particular theory. Now we look at some of the behavioral theories of wages. We've looked at the economical theories where there was a supply and a demand interplay. There was an interplay between the number of laborers involved on the X vis-a-vis the rise in the wages. So this was related to the economics aspect of the theories. Now we will look at the behavioral aspect or perspective. And collectively, these theories are known as the behavioral theories of wages. Now, behavior essentially means, natural reactions or movements to the environment and yourself. So we behave in a certain fashion. So behavior can be termed as a set of interactions, set of thought processes, a mindset, okay, that we have. And it has an interplay between us and the ecosystem in which we exist. Correct? Now, another important aspect of behavior or a critical aspect is that of motivation. Now, what is motivation? Motivation basically is the process of attempting to influence others to do your work, okay, through the possibility of some sort of a gain or a reward. For example, let us say somebody is completely demotivated as an operator in a manufacturing concern. And the supervisor comes and says, since you have worked for 30 years, I am suggesting your name for a long service award where you will be felicitated by the top management. You will be invited along with your family for a dinner at a reputed hotel. And you will be given an award of 11,000 rupees, but you will have to be motivated for the next 1 month because we have an annual target where there is a shortfall. So you have to use your influence. You have to work. You have to take work done from some of the junior operators. And then if this is done in accordance, your name will be suggested from our unit. See how interesting it becomes. There is a psychological impact on this particular labor. This is an attempt to change his behavior. So there is some motivation, there is some objective, there is some possibility of a gain or a reward to this particular individual to improve or change their behavior to make it more productive and conducive to match the organizational's needs and objectives. So one critical factor is the remuneration aspect. Now, why do people go for work? Because they want to live a certain lifestyle. Yeah, so remuneration of every worker has a behavioral objective and seeks to fulfill the survival needs to fulfill their goal. Yeah, so that is what is important. So if, let's say, the senior operator also wants to buy a small car for his family, but is falling short of a certain amount. So he can look forward to maybe that, that reward and recognition amount. He may also aspire to become a senior operator after maybe a few years. Now the increment in the salary from that promotion may be responsible for him being able to buy that car. So this is what is known as motivation. Now, every person intends to get compensated for some effort or the other. Whether it's a blue-collar worker in a management, in a manufacturing setup, whether it's a graduate engineer trainee in a high-end research and design center, or it's a software developer or a tester. Okay, so everybody intends to get a compensation for the skills and the time and subsequently the effort that is taken. So the compensation policy, it is targeted at rewarding the manpower for their skill, the talent, the performance, the effort, the responsibility and the working conditions, and subsequently resulting in an enhancement of their morale for the efficient performance. Now, what is morale? We've already discussed it. It is the positivity, it is the increment in their own self-esteem and their ability to view life as something good. So that's improvement in their spirit itself. Yeah. So the way they come to work will have increased with an increment in the morale. Now here, in the field of economics and the field of wages and salaries, the theories are divided broadly into three categories. One being theories which are related to the content, known as content theories. The next being the process theories, and the last being the contemporary theories. Now, each one of these theories will be looked in further detail in our subsequent discussions. As mentioned previously, we are now going to first have a look at our content theories. Now, content theories basically set the specific context in order to explain what inspires manpower, or in simple terms, the employees at their jobs. Now, you might have heard about some of these important ones like the Herzberg theory, the Maslow theory. We also have another one, which is the Adler-Furr theory. Yeah? So these are three important behavioral scientists, you may say, who have had significant contribution to the content class or the content category of theories. Okay, now corresponding to these behavioral scientists are three theories like Abraham Maslow. Okay, he came up with the hierarchy of needs, which is quite famous today. Herzberg came up with the concept of the two-factor theory, and Adler-Furr came up with the ERG theory, which we are going to subsequently take a look at. So let's look at the first theory. Okay, now this is known as the hierarchy of needs and was proposed by a behavioral scientist known as Abraham Maslow, who has subsequently become very famous because of his proposition of this particular theory. Now, what has he proposed? He has proposed in a pyramid fashion, which we'll see later, the five needs. Like, you know, in the first chapter, I've mentioned about the roti, the kapda, and the makana. So there is a hierarchy. Now, hierarchy means going from the basic level to a higher level of needs. So there is a sort of a hierarchy here. There's a sort of a status quo which is developed over here. Now, what is the hierarchy? The hierarchy is from a physiological, okay, please hear this word carefully, a physiological, which is distinct from a psychological. So a physiological or a basic need. Okay, so basic need means those needs which pertain to our stomach first. Yeah, so those basic needs of hunger, those basic needs of a safety. So if you are surrounded by four walls, you're not under the open sky, you don't dread being killed or robbed, your one need is also satisfied, which is the safety. The next need is that of social recognition. Are you living amongst a society of individuals who care for you? They may include your immediate family, your relatives, your friends, your society members. The next need is that of self-esteem. How do you look when you look at yourself? How do you see yourself? Do you see as yourself as a competent individual? Do you see doing things which are in tune with your education or your knowledge level? So this is a higher order need, which is known as a self-esteem need. And the final need, after you achieve these needs, Abraham Maslow proposed that the final need would be to look within your own self for enlightenment, which is a self-actualization. Can you know the true you? Can you realize your purpose here, and so on? So Maslow believed that within every individual, okay, every employee, every individual, there exists a hierarchy going from a lower level to a higher level of need. And as we've seen, there are five needs here. And each level should be mandatorily satisfied before the individual, before that individual pursues the next level. So if you are, you know, satisfying your food, you can then focus on your safety. correct? So if you have sufficient safety, like a good house, you will then look at the next need, which is a social need, and so on, and then the self-esteem and a self-actualization. So basic needs are at the bottom of the pyramid, with higher needs moving up the hierarchy. And specifically, this is the hierarchy that is mentioned, all right? So that's Mr. Maslow pointing out the hierarchy of needs to us. So here, as we can see, the need in the red in the lower part is nothing but the physiological need. Aspects like food, aspects like breathing, aspects like sleep, the basic bodily needs, aspects like a good health. So if you have food, can you digest it properly without any ailments, without any problems? This is a basic need. The next need is our classical makan, where we can see the security. So we have these four walls, we are possessing a property, and we are safe, correct? We are not living in the open area, we are safe. Then there is a need for love and belonging, yeah? So the need of social, which is, as I had mentioned, friends, family members, people from the society. Then the self-esteem, are you looked upon as somebody who is competent? Are you a respected individual playing your own part? Are you, you know, achieving what you are supposed to with your education, with your knowledge? And finally, the self-actualization. Like, are you understanding your presence? Do you acknowledge self-awareness? Are you good at morality, creativity, spontaneity, problem solving? So are you playing a critical role after receiving an education and having a credibility? For example, let's say Mr. Narayan Murthy or his wife Sudha Murthy, they have reached a specific level where they are only focusing on self-actualization more. Yeah, so they are, looking at the needs of the society. What do people want? All right, they want to have people do more than they aspire. So this is the highest level. Many of us also, now are moving into these particular levels where we have been able to satisfy. So this has become commonplace for us, and we are now working with self-actualization. So this is how a behavioral theory was proposed by the scientist, behavioral scientist, Mr. Abraham Maslow. All right. Now, over here, we can just briefly work through those particular needs which have already been discussed. So we know physiological means bodily. Okay, so it's more to do with a money that you receive, a fair compensation, a sum which you receive, which you utilize to buy the basic products. Like you want to have some bread, you want to have some rice, some resources for cooking, you might want to consume some fruits. So it sounds simple because it is. Now these are the things that are legally required in the scope. So from the perspective of wages, a person, a laborer, basically has to be compensed or remunerated for this sort of a need. This is a lower level need, but it has to be satisfied in the scope of the wages. The next one is a safety need. So these needs are satisfied by the company. There are quite a few. Healthcare may be a safety need. All right. So there is a health coverage, maybe. Healthcare, like a group insurance or a health insurance, because if there is some sort of a disability either within or outside, there is some sort of an insurance which provides a cover. Also, things like a retirement benefit over a long-term security that the employee and their family will be taken care of. Maybe something on the lines of a gratuity, or they might give you a housing. So some of the large companies, they may also have a colony within the premises of that particular organization where they will provide living quarters so that the safety needs are also taken care of. So after the safety needs have been covered, we look at the needs related to the love and belonging. So what place does the person have in the society? So while your employees may not find love in the workplace, of course, you can help them to foster healthy and productive workplace relations. These may include collaboration amongst them and the fellow employees. This could include the respect and empathy that they can provide, the compassion that can be there. So it could be a lovely ecosystem. This can also be facilitated through workday events for employees, certain group trainings, team building exercises, group picnics, family days, as I had mentioned about a long service award, all these kind of things, a town hall. These could make people feel wanted. Okay, don't forget that these are an important but often forgotten part of your company's added benefits. So just imagine when you are the place where you've worked, your family, especially your children, come and see that workplace, you feel really proud. The next part relates to the image that people see themselves, the esteem. So many people's self-esteem comes from the confidence that they gain at work. So the knowledge that is converted into skills is something critical to raising or lifting this self-esteem. So it's critical that, the organizations help employees succeed and encourage respect and appreciation for others. Rewarding people for performance feeds this basic need. So such rewards can be given in different ways. Maybe a few people can be identified as subject matter experts who could help the new or the novice people, the novice employees. So they feel motivated. They could be promoted because of these efforts. They could be given an incentive. They could be showcased. Their efforts should be showcased in a local R&R. They could be given spot awards and so on. So this tends to boost the esteem of the employees. Now the last level in this particular hierarchy of needs, we've also seen a diagram, is that of self-actualization. Now there's a famous quote by Maslow himself who states, what a man can be, he must be. So a man has to graduate, the employee has to graduate into the level of self-actualization. So this thought is what the need for self-actualization is based on, correct? So self-actualization includes the need to accomplish everything that you can. So are you gaining some insights about how you interact with others in a given environment? Are you able to control your emotions? Are you able to gain wisdom through various mediums that can make you self-actualized? Are you in continuous or complete connect with yourself? So if these are the things, if you're also happy in a given situation, if you're not suffering from any sort of delusions, if you don't possess biases, you're supposed to attain a level which is self-actualization. This is easier said than done, and people themselves have to also play a part rather than the organization themselves. So organizations can only go a certain way, but the people need to achieve this. Thank you.